Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Monica Garby, who works in family mediation, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about the topic today. Hello, Monica. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello, Barry.
Okay, Monica, so can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yes, well, I trained many years ago as a social worker with a sort of called probation option. So basically, I trained as a probation officer. And I worked in the field of probation for about 10 years. And then I moved over to work in the civil courts, where I became a children's guardian, court welfare officer. They have many titles, basically, depending on what type of law you're doing. But in that arena, you are appointed by the courts to be an officer of the court as an independent person who the judge comes to rely upon in terms of deciding what is in the best interests of children in contact residence disputes. Mm-hmm. It is a pivotal role in the court setting because the judge only has you to rely on as their independent expert. So you are in the hot seat. Your decision is critical because for a judge to go against your decision is appealable, and judges don't like to be appealed against. So you are the pressure is very much on you in that setting. And as part and parcel of that job at the time, I dabbled a little bit in mediation with some of the less entrenched cases, you might say. And I liked it. I saw it as a quicker solution. To catch it earlier, to encourage people to work together, to save them from the fate that I knew was laying in wait for them, because to go through court proceedings is a lose-lose as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And then an opportunity came my way, and I eventually left the court welfare world and set up in business as a mediator. In fact, I've been doing that for the past 10, 12, 15 years, I think. I can't remember. I lose track of time. But, you know, the business has grown considerably. And as a family mediator, I've worked resolving financial cases, children's cases, occasionally a bit on inheritance. And more recently, I've trained as a commercial mediator. But my expertise and my experience is in the family.
Okay. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the process of family mediation?
Yeah, as a family mediator, I mean, I think what might be helpful if I sort of explain what I explain to clients when mm-hmm. they come to see me and how they receive it as a way. I say to people when they come along, in simple layperson's terms, these kind of disputes, there are only ever two ways that you can resolve them. To do with children, finances. One is you fight about it, and the other is you try and see if there is a way forward. If you fight and you go to the court, and the court will give you a decision. But that process is very tortuous, it's very expensive, and you will have no control over that process. Mm. And the amount of time that the court will give you will be significant less than you imagine. Or alternatively, you might try to negotiate a settlement. And you've got routes by which you might go about that. You might appoint solicitors to try and negotiate for you. You might get around your kitchen table. Or you might come to mediation. And there are pros and cons with each process. And nothing is perfect. The solicitor route is very familiar to people. And it has advantages because you don't have to do it. Somebody's going to front it for you, but the downside is it costs a lot of money, and there's something about the power of the written word from a solicitor that can sometimes inflame a dispute. Mm-hmm. The other option, the other extreme, you get around your kitchen table. It's your time, your money. So, you know, whatever. And if you can do that, great, fantastic. But lots of people can't because the emotion gets in the way.
Right.
Or they get so far and they don't know what their options are. So we're left with mediation. And mediation, I describe to people, is a bit of a hybrid between those two positions,
mm-hmm.
whereby you come. There's maybe one or two mediators. If there's two mediators, they're working as a team. It's not one each. The mediators are neutral. They're not on anybody's side. And if they are working at the capacity, they must have no investment in the outcome.
Okay.
And everybody else has an investment. But their strength comes from the fact that they are entirely neutral.
Yeah.
And what the mediator's role in that situation is to look at what is the process that these people have to go through in order to get their deal?
Mm.
What are the legal constraints? What might be the financial constraints? To look at options that other people haven't considered. And by having a neutral person in that situation, it's often easier for them to ask the questions than the coming from the other person. Because however reasonable those questions are coming from the other side, it's too emotional for the other person to hear it sometimes.
Yeah.
I can ask the same question and tougher questions and get away with it because, hey, I don't have an investment in the outcome other than to try and do a good job.
Yeah.
So that's in essence what mediation is about.
Okay. Is mediation all about compromise?
Not altogether. I would say in order for it to kind of have a sporting chance, people have to come to the table willing to look at options, to think outside of the box, to think of things that they might not have thought of. But every settlement is different because what we're talking about is a bespoke arrangement which is right for those people. And no two settlements are ever alike. And what's right for one couple might be completely different for another. And it's really how they can they live with it is the question that we ask people. Not are you happy with it? Is that everything that you want? Can you live with the settlement that, you know, we're working towards? And if the answer to that is yes, then what we'd say to people is just be mindful of the fact that you are negotiating at a time in your life when emotions are running very high.
Mm.
And that bodes very well for the future, that in years to come, if you can live with it now, 2, 3, 4 years from time, chances are you will think that's a really good settlement.
Yeah. Okay. So it's more about people getting their needs met within reason.
Yeah, within reason. But there are often very real difficult constraints for people financially,
yeah.
emotionally, practically. You know, there are not always dead easy answers, but then the other routes aren't necessarily going to give it them either.
Okay. Do you ever get people coming along thinking that you're marriage guidance counsellors?
Yes, yeah, we do. And we're very quick to point out that we are not about getting people back together again. What we're here about is to separate people in as kindly a way as possible.
Right, so would you say family mediation is right for everyone?
No, I wouldn't. And indeed, that's part of when we see people individually to begin with, part of our assessment is to check that people understand what they are entering into. And also, we are checking to make sure that there are no constraints or no concerns, rather, I should say, around child protection issues, domestic violence. That's not to say that you can't mediate when those things are present. I suppose the answer is it depends. It depends where people are at, what involvement social services have, what constraints there are. For example, just to make that come alive a bit really, it's very, very common, for example, for there to be domestic violence when relationships are coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to condone it or say it's right. It's just to say it's a fact. And it's very much how the individual feels about it. You might make an assessment as to if domestic violence has been a one-off however awful, is sometimes can be different to ongoing years and years of abuse and harassment where people are in fear of their lives. You might make a distinction. The person themselves might make a distinction and say, yes, there has been abuse, but actually this is a much better way for me to resolve this, given my other choices. And actually I feel it is quite empowering to be able to come to the table and face this. We just need to make sure that people are safe, and that, you know, we're not setting anybody up.
Okay, what would happen in a mediation when emotions are very raw? How would you tackle, say, a situation where children are involved?
Yeah, this is a very commonplace situation, and they are, by their nature, they're very tricky because, as you point out, emotions are often running very high. When dealing typically with a children's situation, what we try and do is sort of, it's a mixture of getting people to think but also giving them lots of information. And what I sort of tend to try and get across to people is, look, there's, in order to make a contact, make things right for children, or improve things for children, there are two key points to be addressed. One is we need to deal with the mechanics of the, what, by which I mean the what, when and how. What is the deal going to be? Mm-hmm. And that you find is something that, that the adults, the parents, are very preoccupied with. It's quite interesting, really. But there is another key fundamental bit, which I would say is even more important than that, and that is the spirit. What's the deal? What's going on behind the scenes? Are people working to make this deal, or are they pulling in opposite directions once the door's closed? Yeah. And interestingly, when you talk to children, as I have done over the years, they are preoccupied with the spirit. The parents are preoccupied with quantum, how much time they're going to get. And, you know, of course that's important. But children, it's all about the atmosphere in which it takes place.
Okay.
And children are hugely sensitive to this. They can, without parents even saying anything or doing anything, they can smell it. They can absolutely, you know, feel it. So... We identify this in the mediation, and we will spend time on the mechanics, but when we're getting down to the real nitty-gritty, we will talk them through the spirit. And what I, one of the ways I do that, or we do that together, is we just try and look at the process that they are in by saying, and trying to get them to look at it from the child's point of view. So it's really forcing the child's agenda on the table, because they, parents will often say that is the most important thing to them, but actually what they're doing, and not willfully, or sometimes willfully, they are not working in the children's best interests. What we say is, look, this, again, this thing, when people separate, you've got two routes. You either go down the consensus route or you go down the conflict route. And I get people to sort of think about what the conflict looks like. They're very familiar with that. They know what that involves. And say, look, you know, you go around the loop with that and you'll go to all various people to try and resolve that, the police, the courts, the solicitor, the mediator, the psychologist. If that fails, you start sending the child to the psychologist, the mediator, the, you know, and on it goes. And all these people who are involved in this conflict resolution are sticking plasters. All they're trying to do is just sort it to one degree or another. But if those people in the conflict have no investment in sorting it genuinely, that can go on for as long as they want to fight. Mm-hmm. It will be there. And if they were just wanting to fight amongst themselves, that was their personal choice. Well, that's their personal choice. The trouble is, we know from research what happens to children in that scenario. So I will explain to them about what the research does, says rather, about children in that conflict situation. Because what we know from research is that children who are in that situation, they can often cope with the separation of the parents. The bit they can't cope with is the conflict.
Yeah.
And it impacts them on their education, their psychological health, their ability to sustain relationships, their mental health. On it goes.
Yeah.
And you find that some children are more robust than others, some children are not so. And then the common criticism that comes from that is, oh, well, you know, that's your poor children, that's your deprived children. And that's a fair comment. But the research has been done, and this research has been done all over the world. It's been done in Canada, Sweden, Australia, you name it. And it was a criticism of that initial critique of those observations. They went back and looked at it again and they said, no, this is irrespective of class. Just money does shield you a little bit from these things, because you can move the children to boarding school, you've got a little bit more wriggle room, but fundamentally children are massively impacted by conflict. So if everybody's saying the most important thing to them is their children, they want to do the best, and indeed that's what they're saying, what you're saying is, right, well, if you mean what you say you mean, can we look at it in a different model? Because this is going under your radar and you have to consciously do something different in order to make it right for your children. Otherwise, what you will find is children will have to find methods to resolve this because they have to live it. You've retreated to your separate places. The child has the choice of either choosing between the two of you, and that's a very hard decision for a child, or they have to compartmentalise their life. And I get people to say, imagine what it'd be like if you had two employers. You were very loyal to those employers, but they never spoke to each other. You had to work for them. You couldn't get another job. You were fixed in that, but it caused you huge grief. Get adults to imagine what it's like when their two best friends have fallen out and the jealousies. And I point out to them, as an adult, you can walk away from that. As a child, you can't. So we start to look at, well, how do these other people do it? And I use the example of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, because the joke about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers is, apparently, as we all know, they were fantastic dance partners. But actually, behind the scenes, the truth of the story is that they didn't really get on terribly well. Mm-hmm. But they cut a deal, and they had a very successful deal to the outside world. And I'm saying, you know, you can have your Fred and Ginger deal, but you have to be very clear about what the ground rules are. So what are the things that are really, really upsetting you? And people will come up with their suggestions. So we say, well, let's have some rules about, you know, how we speak to one another. And interestingly, they're usually the same kind of things that come up. I can predict what they are. And if people are struggling, I can tell them. I know what the things that will be causing their problems.
Yeah.
And we can put that in. Now, that takes integrity for people to say, okay, I can see that that's really upsetting you. I might not necessarily agree, but I will do X, Y, and Z because that makes you happier. If that makes you happier, I might get something of what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So you're moving people to a more cooperative model of parenting. And a crucial bit in that is how they communicate and when they communicate, so that the child gets the message, do you know what, I don't have to do this anymore because somebody else is taking care of this for me. And that is such a relief to children. And I say to parents, you know, that is the most kindest gift you can give your children, above any of this, and they will thank you for that. But it will become a personal sacrifice to you, but it will get easier, right, as it goes on.
Yeah. Okay, does it work then?
I would say it can work. It doesn't work in every case, but if you can get people round the table, I think its success rate is about 65-70%.
Okay.
But the tricky bit is actually getting people in the same room together, and getting people in the same room, if it's going to work, that's when the magic will happen.
Okay.
There are different models of mediation where you do what we call shuttle mediation, where you're running backwards and forwards between the parties. Personally, that's not something that I favour because I don't see it as effective and there's lots of pitfalls. So the model that we operate is with people being in the same room together.
And what do you find are the most effective strategies? If you find people are really sort of stuck at that position, do you find certain strategies that can work?
I think sometimes it's about saying to people, well, come along and see, you are in control, you can stop it at any time you like, you can have breaks at any time you like. Saying to people, what are the other alternatives? And I suppose it's also the economics of the situation for a lot of people, you know, costly divorces and solicitor's fees and And often I say to people, you know, you'll get a very clear idea, probably in the first session, whether this is going somewhere.
Right, okay. What do you feel are its limitations?
Well, people can renege on the deal because it's not legally binding. It can be made legally binding in financial matters after the mediation. So, you know, there are kind of steps that can be taken. But I would say there's a lot of things that would add, you could offer as a counterweight to that, in that, you know, I say to people, how else are they going to sort this? And going to court, whilst it might deal with the hard facts around the case, it does not deal with the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotional stuff is as important as the practicalities.
Okay. Can it be abused?
Yes, I think people can. I think it becomes readily apparent.
Okay.
If somebody's abusing it, and it will be relatively short-lived.
Okay.
But anything can be abused.
Well, we've touched on this a little bit, but what sort of dogmatic views tend to get in people's way in family disputes? Do you see any patterns?
I think if people are wedded to principles,
mm-hmm.
That can be very difficult, because if you have issues in principle, it's often a yes-no answer,
yeah.
And yes-no answers often have to go to court. But in my experience, a lot of people are not issues in principle. They want a solution. They're desperate for a solution.
Yeah, okay. When you come across these entrenched principles, do you have any strategies there to sort of chip away at them?
One of the things, we did a number of strategies we employ. One is we try and get people to think about what's important to them, why it's important, and how they propose it's going to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
We also get people to try and future focus how they might like it to be, and sort of tap into getting them to sort of suspend reality and think about how it could be.
Okay.
And then work backwards what needs to go in place in order to reach that goal. So to sort of try and take them out of the moment. The other strategy that we employ is giving them a heavy, heavy dose of reality of what the alternatives are. And I have to say, you know, because of my background as a children's guardian CAFCAS officer, and I work with a colleague who's a family lawyer, we've been to court on many, many an occasion. We've sat with the judges. We know what judges say off camera, on camera, and we can share that information with people. And because people are often very, very ill informed as to what the final outcome is going to be, or how they imagine that they're going to have this day in court where all wrongs are going to be righted, where everybody's going to see it from their point of view. And part of our task is to say nothing could be further from the truth, and you're going to end up with a massive bill, and you are still going to have to work with this other person, particularly if you have children. So then what? So we can really, you know, hammer that one home.
Right. Okay. Do you see the process that you follow in mediation being mirrored in other spheres, like political or social?
I do. I think because I think often about, you know, sort of global conflicts, and the one that stands out in mind to me is South Africa. When I see South Africa, you know, was at a sort of crossroads in its choices. There was every possibility that there could have been a bloodbath in that country, which not only would have happened in our generation, but would have sown the seeds for, you know, you have to look at Northern Ireland, it goes on and on and on, you know, yeah. Righting the wrongs. And I have to say, I think Tutu's idea of truth and reconciliation was absolute genius.
Mm.
And when you analyse it, it's mediation, really, because one of the things that they did was they introduced people saying sorry and people being willing to accept sorry, no, the history wasn't changed, nobody came back from the dead, nobody, nothing really, there was no big sort of compensation at work. It was people coming prepared in all sincerity to say that they were sorry, and people being willing at some level to accept that. I'm not saying it's perfect by any manner of means, but compared with what can happen, mm-hmm. you only have to look at what happened with it's happening now in Syria.
Yeah. If you think of conflict resolution in general, in your experience, what would you say are some of the essential ingredients?
I think it's a willingness to say sorry. I think it's willingness to accept sorries. I think it's trying to look for solutions and thinking, what does that person want to fix this? So less time on the justifications, more time on the solutions. It's very easy in all these things, you know, to spend lots of time on the history, on the who's done what to who. And it's much harder to look for the solutions. So I say keep the history and the who's done what to who at a minimum, and the energy focused on how we're going to solve it from a very practical point of view. That's difficult when emotional level is high. Mm-hmm. And that's where mediators can assist, because I see it all the time when people are arguing about things. Sometimes people are actually saying quite conciliatory things, but the other person is so upset and emotional they don't actually hear what has been said. And one of the skills of a mediator, you were asking me before about some of the skills, is to say, can I just stop you now? Did you just hear what that person said? Can you just repeat what you said? Mm-hmm. Repeat it again. Did you hear that? Did you hear what's being said? And sometimes in the fight that gets, and more often than you would imagine.
Okay. Do you find yourself using the skills you've developed as a mediator in your own life?
I try. I can't say, you know, I too am human,
yeah.
and I have my moments
yeah.
as well. I do try. I think the apology thing, I like to think I do try and practice that.
Okay.
And I do see it works. You know, often you can just cut to the chase,
yeah.
save a lot of time and energy.
Yeah. Has to be sincere though, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it has to be sincere, yes. And it does have to be sincere. And there has to be a willingness to put it to rest.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my last question, Monica, what is the biggest thing you've learned from being a mediator?
It's never straightforward. And I think the success of mediation often boils down to, and I've learned this, that people's willingness to say sorry, proper sorries, and people's willingness to accept sorry. I would also say people's willingness to try and imagine how it feels for the other person, however difficult that might be. And critically, people's willingness to move on to solutions and to explore solutions, however imperfect they might be, rather than constantly rehearsing the problem or identifying problems. People get stuck on the identifying of the problem but never move on to the solution.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that,
thank
Monica.
You.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.